No, it is not we who are buying time. It is our young men who are buying the time for the whole free world to rearm. Are we doing as much as we possibly can with this time, as quickly as we can? That is the question we all should be asking ourselves. What are we doing with the time being bought for us at so great a price? I would be less than frank if I did not say I do not believe that we as a nation, our allies, are doing enough.
The governor of California, Earl Warren, had yet to indicate his position on the debate. We called Governor Warren and asked him, as a result of the testimony of MacArthur, Marshall, and Bradley thus far, what conclusions had he been able to reach? This was the governor's reply.
It is a sad spectacle for most Americans, I am sure, to see our greatest soldiers publicly disputing not only foreign policy, but military strategy and soldierly conduct as well. Our enemies must gain comfort from it, and the morale of our own fighting forces cannot be improved by it. However, I have reached the conclusion that the acrimony and resulting confusion should not discourage us. It has served at least one good purpose. It has refocused the attention of millions of Americans on our international problem. It has demonstrated that we as a nation are confronted with great global problems and with corresponding responsibilities. The testimony to date must have convinced most people of the old saying that no matter how thin you make a pancake, there are always two sides to it. Eliminate the personalities engaged in the debate, erase the partisan bitterness which it has engendered, and one finds a core of discussion that can lead to a straightforward and clear-cut declaration of American foreign policy. And more than that, a declaration that can be understood by the American people, because at long last, they will have had the facts. Certainly, the Senate hearings to date give us reason not only to expect, but to demand that the contesting forces will soon join together in formulating a unified foreign policy.
The two men most likely to meet in the 1952 finals both spoke this week, Harry Truman and Bob Taft. Each spoke about the other, but without mentioning any names.
It is with tremendous pride and with unbounded appreciation of his valor and his love of country that I present to you the world's greatest statesman and the next president of the United States, Senator Robert A. Taft.
Senator Taft spoke in Dayton, surprised no one by saying he would run if nominated, then spoke of the problems we face.
I believe the Democrats themselves came to the conclusion that if they were going to have to face the people of this country in 52 on the domestic issues, they were going to lose. I don't say that they deliberately turned the whole tendency of the present Congress to the foreign issue. Certainly that is the effect of what they've done. Perhaps they were forced into it. But in any event, today, in all probability, in 1952, we face a campaign on foreign policy, primarily. They have at least succeeded, whether deliberately or otherwise, in diverting the public attention from the domestic issues where the Republican Party has certainly secured today a majority support from the people, and they have presented to us the foreign issue.
President Truman spoke on Thursday morning, had prepared for delivery a rather routine speech on the domestic economy. But just before airtime, he discarded much of his typewritten text and ad-libbed.
A suggestion was made by one senator the other day that we ought to cut down the gold for our armed forces by 500,000 men. And this same senator wants to go for an all-out war in China all by ourselves. At a time like this, such a cut would be foolish. Not only foolish, it would be most dangerous. Slashing the size of our armed forces would not be economy. It would be an invitation to war. Let me drive that home. What we are attempting to do now, in the next year and a half, we anticipate may cost about $60 billion. 1 week of all-out war would cost from 10 to 20 times that. We must have friends in this troubled world. Yet some senators and some other people would have us go it alone. in this world of ours, in this day, we can't go it alone. There's a free world and there's a slave world. We belong to the free world and we are the head of the free world, and we've got to accept that responsibility and carry out that responsibility.
In Pennsylvania, Harold E. Stassen stated that he thought the hearings going on in Washington might be quite academic in the long run.
The answers in the great MacArthur debate over Korean-Chinese policy will not come from the battle of questioning in Washington. The answers will come from the battlefields of Korea. If the war in Korea quiets down, or a ceasefire or settlement is worked out soon, sentiment will swing to support President Truman's administration. But if the fighting continues in an endless, bloody loss of American lives, public opinion will insist upon the adoption of General MacArthur's program.
Who is ready?
If the war in Korea was nearing its end, it was news to the men on the 120-mile line. You are listening to A Gun Position as this howitzer pounds round after round into the advancing human sea, which this week again began to attack.
Still hear that shell hissing through the air. A huge cloud of smoke and dust has now risen from the ground surrounding the...
One of the most powerful and concentrated artillery walls in history stood blocking the second big communist offensive of the last 30 days. These guns and our planes, our mines, our artillery, and our barbed wire caused thousands of enemy deaths. But the Chinese, in their fashion, kept marching over their own dead, pushing into our lines. A South Korean division fell back before them, and the Chinese split an American division, trapped some of its elements. Censorship from the front is holding up the full story. But tonight we know some of these men fought their way to safety in the South. Others are still fighting their way out. So far, the enemy has not thrown his full strength into battle. The action is concentrated on the East and East Central Front. We are waiting for a new blow in the West, in the Seoul area. And all along the line, where they are not tonight under communist attack, United Nations troops are ready for whatever the communists can throw at them. In one of the thousands of valleys of South Korea, our reporter, Jack Jefferson, turned on his recording machine. Here there was no tremendous artillery fire, no boom of gun and zoom of plane. Here there was an enemy attack and quiet. An American battalion somewhere in South Korea at 4 a.m.
One of our battalions is receiving a bonsai attack. We have lost telephone communication with one company and maintaining it by radio.
An hour later, and the correspondent, like the soldier, waits and wonders.
Just a few more hours now until daylight. It is growing lighter out, but the fog and rain is still pressing in on us in this little valley. The danger, while it is not past, certainly the end of the pitch blackness is a little more easing on the nerves.
Our planes are grounded. Our guns are having difficulty finding targets because of the weather.
The long night is at last over. Though the visibility is good, I believe the regiment will soon be on the move and we will get our CP out of this narrow valley surrounded by hills.
And now, 3 hours after the attack, this regiment prepares to do its day's work.
Tanks are being moved up to the two companies under the bonsai attack.
It is all along the front. The fanatical enemy attacking and dying to the sound of his own cymbals in some sectors, and the quiet, watchful waiting in others. The enemy casualty toll in these past few days has been very heavy. We are given no indication thus far of our own losses. But from Generals Ridgway and Van Fleet today came these words: "We have met the first test. There will be more. The enemy attempt to destroy us will be futile." In Chicago, where in the fall of 1942 the atom age had its birth, there was this week on the campus of the same university another important event in the history of the atom.
The University of Chicago today dedicates these institutes to the progress and strength of the nation.
That was an official of the University of Chicago as he dedicated the new $11 million atomic research laboratories. We took our microphones into the accelerator building, which houses the world's most powerful atom smasher, a synchro cyclotron capable of delivering 450 million volt atomic punch. We wanted to see this new $2.5 million monster gadget, which will provide basic research information on the structure of matter, information upon which future developments for peace or otherwise depend. A big, slow-moving elevator carried us underground into a concrete and steel-walled basement called the Experimental Pit. We were met by Dr. Herbert Anderson, who directed the building of the synchro cyclotron.
The cyclotron itself is a very large machine. It consists of a large electromagnet whose weight is 2,200 tons, about the same weight as a destroyer. In addition to the magnet, there is a high-frequency oscillator similar to those which are used in television broadcasting.
The cyclotron is a sort of atomic slingshot that whirls fragments of atoms in a giant circle and throws them at terrific speed at other metals or gases. The result can be atomic fission, a small-scale replica of the fission which goes on in the atomic bomb. We walked around the machine and picked up the sounds of the auxiliary equipment.
This is the oil circulating device that circulates oil around the bearing of the rotary condenser, which is inside the machine. Room supplies the mechanical vacuum to back the main vacuum pumps, and also houses the 1,000-kilowatt motor generator set.
The cyclotron eats up enough power to light a city of 50,000 people. Dr. Anderson gave the order to start up the cyclotron while we listened.
Now, this door weighs 70 tons and separates the space where the cyclotron is and where the experiments are carried on. The purpose of the door is to close the passage between the two places and thereby protect people working with the meson beam from the dangerous radiation issued from the cyclotron. I'll press the button and start this door closing. We've got the door now closed now, and if everyone is out of the cyclotron chamber, we'll be able to turn on the beam. Mr. Cornbus, will you turn on the beam?
The beam will be on in 30 seconds.
That's the warning bell. In 30 seconds, the high voltage will be turned on the oscillator.
When that steady bell becomes intermittent, the world's most powerful cyclotron will be manufacturing 450 million volts of atomic force.
Here comes the beam. The beam is on now. The intermittent bell means that the beam is on.
Within the actual cyclotron, only the ringing of the bell and complete quiet as the pale, luminous beam goes to work, with the same kind of silence and hope that accompanied that first man-made chain reaction on that same college campus 9 years ago.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for air based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is WDWS, CBS in Champaign-Urbana. Men, the cord suits you've been asking for are at Pat Kane's 202 North Neal in Champaign. What style, what comfort, these rayon and nylon cord suits are priced from $25.50 to $40. What a reasonable price. Choose from checks or stripes, blue, brown, or gray. Ask for rayon and nylon cord suits at Pat Kane's, and you ask for the finest. Pat Kane's at 202 North Neal in Champaign.